1 Timothy chapter 3, if you will, this morning. And this will be non-optional leadership part 5. Non-optional for our nation, non-optional for our communities, for our ecclesias, for our homes, and for us as even individuals, being that nearly all, as I've pointed out in the past, that nearly all of the, not all, but nearly all, of Yahweh's leadership qualifications are qualities that He expects in all of us as His servants and His ambassadors, regardless our chosen vocation. In other words, whether we're in an ecclesiastical leadership position or not, all of them are qualities, or nearly all of them, excuse me, are qualities that God expects in every one of us, male and female alike. 1 Timothy chapter 3, picking it up with basically where we left off. 1 Timothy chapter 3, verses, let's begin with verse 1 again. It says, "This is a true saying, if a man desire the office of a bishop," Titus uses the word elder there. Again, it's synonymous with overseer or pastor. If a man desires the office of a bishop, he desireth a good work. A bishop then must be blameless, the husband of one wife, and then jump down to verse 4, one that ruleth well his own house, having his children in subjection with all gravity. The second qualification, we've already dealt with it to some extent, but the second qualification for official leadership in the ecclesia is that the man, or the candidate in this case, must rule his household well. And note the two counterbalancing words, the word rule and the word well. They really are counterbalancing. A leader must not only rule his home, and in some cases the greater ecclesia, he must rule well. There are many men who rule. There's a lot of men who should rule who don't. But there are many men who rule, but few who rule well. And we can particularly see that in government today. We can look to Washington, D.C. and to our state capitals, and we can see that all over the place, that there are many men who rule, but there are very, very few who rule well. There are many men who rule their homes, but there are few who rule well. Most any man can rule. Most any man. There are some men who simply can't. But most any man can rule. The challenge in this is in ruling well. Consequently, men, it should be your goal not only to rule. That's really, it should be inherent within us. But it should be to rule well, resulting in wives and children who are, well, I won't say eagerly, but who are at least willingly in subjection to our headship or our authority. And how I would ask you, we kind of dealt with all of that in the last message, but how I would ask you, is a congregation or a community to know whether a man qualifies in this regard unless the candidate lives among and is selected from among those who know him, with whom he lives. Deuteronomy chapter 1 and verse 13. I think we've looked at it at least that and maybe a verse or two more in some of the past messages. But in Deuteronomy 1 and verse 13 again, Moses to the men of the tribes of Israel said the following. He said, "Take you wise men." We need to at least start there. We could use some wise men in Washington, D.C. these days. But he says, "Take you wise men and understanding," and I think this next part of this is so often overlooked as being probably almost inconsequential, and yet it is so extremely important, particularly as it concerns the qualification that we're dealing with, the second qualification that we're dealing with now in the qualifications of elders and overseers in the ecclesia. He says, take you wise men in understanding and known among your tribes. Not just anybody, not just somebody who comes along and says, hey, I'm a great guy, you know, vote for me. But he says, who is known among your tribes, and I will make them rulers over you. In other words, the roving or the multi-congregational pastor is essentially unbiblical. You know, the guy that always, he's a year or 2 years here, and then he's a year or 2 years here and there and beyond, is essentially such a roving multi-congregational pastor is essentially unbiblical, except such a man comes with a letter of endorsement from his home congregation, which verifies his good standing and his biblical qualifications. Something, by the way, that applies as much to the non-pastor as it does the pastor. We have these people who just rove around from church to church. They have a problem with one church, or the church has a problem with them more often than not, and all of a sudden they're showing up in another church and welcome arms, you know, just invite them in. Hey, we got another somebody else to fill part of the pew. Instead of saying, wait a minute, where'd you come from? Who are you? You remember with Apollos, after Priscilla and Aquila had taught him more accurately? And what did they do after he was baptized into Christ? Because that was what was missing in his life. They sent him when he went on, I think, to Corinth, if I remember correctly. They sent him with a letter of commendation. You know, and yet, so how often is that done today? And particularly as it concerns a leader. Oh, you're a pastor. Man, you can preach. I've heard you preach, man. Come on in here. Well, maybe he can preach. But maybe he doesn't qualify as a pastor, elder, or overseer. Otherwise, elders or pastors, if not with a letter of commendation, need to be homegrown. They need to start in their congregation, prove themselves, and they need to have needs to be verified by the congregation that, in fact, they do qualify in this regard, having raised a family in Christ that is in subjection. And then, of course, selected from among those who know him, or thus selected from those who know him and can vouch for him, and then elected by Yahweh by means of the lot. By the way, speaking of Yahweh's election process by lots, we've dealt with that in other messages and a message or two previous to this one in this series. But something I just came across or just realized this past week concerning Yahweh's election process by lots. And something that I think is very telling, something in addition to what I've shared and seen myself in the past regarding this, but very telling as to the importance that obviously God, that Yahweh, places upon his election process, which is an election process by lot, as it was in Acts chapter 1, if you'll recall. And here's what I came across. Although in 1 Samuel 9, and we won't go to these passages, you can look them up on yourself, but you'll probably remember this. In 1 Samuel chapter 9, Yahweh, if you'll recall, had revealed to Samuel first his choice of Saul as Israel's first king. Remember, Saul is out looking for the donkeys? And God says, hey, the young man who's going to be coming to you about some donkeys, he's Israel's next king, and I want you to anoint him. And in fact, did anoint him as they departed. And so although in 1 Samuel 9, Yahweh himself reveals to Samuel his choice, what is his choice already of Saul, in 1 Samuel 10, in verses 17 through 21, he still used lots to make known his choice to the people, that it wasn't Samuel's choice, but that it was Yahweh's choice. It verified to the people that this was God's choice. You know, I'm once again amazed how we have missed and neglected Yahweh's election process. I mean, I have yet to hear anybody ever preach on this. And I've missed it for years. And here's something else that adds to that whole picture. And you can only wonder how much more we've overlooked, not only in this, but how many other areas or things that we have yet to discover that's just waiting there for us to discover. It's, again, testimony to what Hebrews 4:12 says, that the Word of God is living and active and sharper than a two-edged sword. And if we'll just take the time to immerse ourselves in it, we're going to keep understanding and gleaning more and more. Again, out there gold mining, or at least finding some dust occasionally on top of the earth. And if we dig long enough, we're going to find some nuggets, and oftentimes those nuggets end up leading to a vein of gold that sometimes leads us to a mother lode. I believe this is one of the mother lodes that has so much implication on this whole idea of Christian leadership and a Christian ecclesia put together as God designed it, especially in contrast to what we have today with man's substitute election process, which puts all the emphasis not even on the electors, but the candidate who essentially chooses himself for no other good reason other than he says to himself, I'm qualified. Completely contrary, all of it, completely contrary to Yahweh's plan of leadership and how they come about. Back to Yahweh's requirements that leaders must rule their households well. As it concerns the whole concept of non-optional leadership for all of us, or in this case at least as men, whereas it is not a requirement that every man, as merely a Christian, be married and have children. That is not a requirement. While that is not a requirement, it is biblically required, or at least biblically expected of us, that every man who is married and has children be the head of his home. In other words, this leadership qualification is non-optional. Again, the marriage aspect, the having children of this is not. But for those who are husbands and fathers, this is another non-optional leadership qualification for all of us, even when we are not holding an official leadership capacity or position. And as such, this headship requirement for all who are husbands and fathers needs to be taught to both our sons and our daughters. As one of the most, if not the most, perhaps, important aspects or principles that we will pass on to our sons and daughters for their future success as husbands and wives. Our daughters need to be taught. You say, well, that's no. We just need to teach our men to rule, right? No. We need to teach our daughters. Our daughters need to be taught that no young man, even one chosen by their fathers, as it should be, should be a choice for a husband, unless at the time of engagement or betrothal, they can make a commitment to follow that young man to the ends of the earth, if that so happens to be where he ends up leading them. Not based upon, certainly not based upon passion or infatuation, that is, Twitterfation, or even love for the man. Not based upon even love for the man, but instead based upon respect and esteem for him as a man of great spiritual conviction and hopefully potential as well. And one whom she can trust with her life as it concerns her sustenance and her and her children's future. Now, that should almost be a given. But we look out in the world today, and that is such rare teaching. It's with this whole dating concept, this whole dating atmosphere is not the right word, but that's, I'm sure you understand what I'm saying, that is now so prevalent. It's like, let them go out and date, let them fall in love, and everything's based on love. And everything, it would seem, that's based merely on love fails. And more often than not, it's nothing more than sex appeal to begin with. Our young ladies need to be taught that, initially, forget love. Don't even go there until you have enough respect for that young man to say, I am willing to follow him to the ends of the earth, and then find out about the love part of it. And oftentimes that is never completely developed until after marriage in the first place. He needs to be a man of one in whom one in whom his goals become her goals. And not that she loses her identity or forfeits all of her own personal goals. But nevertheless, because Yahweh designed for husbands and wives to become one, not two together, but one. Because he designed husbands and wives to become one, and because there can be only one head. One head as intended by Yahweh, the husband. The husband's goals are to be the wife's goals. The same as our goals as the bride of Christ is to be Christ's goals. Or maybe I should say it the other way around. The same as Christ's goals should be the bride of Christ's goals. And thus, the example that is provided to us in Ephesians 5, verse 22 through 24. In fact, let's turn to that passage. Ephesians chapter 5, and beginning with verse 22. The example, it says, wives, submit yourselves to your own husbands as unto the Lord. Young ladies, that commitment needs to be made before betrothal. He has to have already proved himself to be such a man that you can say, that is indeed what I will do. Wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands. Don't wait until after the marriage to find out he's not a man worth submitting to. You better find out beforehand. Wives, submit yourselves unto your own husbands as unto the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, or the ecclesia, and he is the Savior of the body. Therefore, as the church is subject unto Christ, so let wives be to their husbands in everything. Now, I don't know if you thought it about this way or not, but really what that's saying there when it says in everything, first of all, it means in everything. But it also means that his goals for his life, for his wife's life, for his family's life, for the future, you need to be so convinced that he is the type of man that is worthy of such submission that you are willing to say at the time of betrothal or engagement, his goals will in fact be my goals. Consequently, young ladies, or let me put it this way, consequently, no young lady should ever marry a man unless she is absolutely convinced that he's the cut of man with whom she can make such a commitment. Again, don't find out after it's too late. And how many marriages have ended up in divorce for that very reason? And if for no other reason, young ladies, then this is what every man desires most from his wife. He doesn't desire most from his wife, love. He wants to be loved. But that's not what he desires most. He desires most what we're talking about in this thing. As in Ephesians 5 and verse 33, where it says, "And let the wife see to it that she reverence her husband." And ladies, don't fall for the watered-down, politically correct versions that use respect in place of reverence. The example Yahweh inspired is the ecclesias, the bride of Christ's relationship with her husband. And it's not merely respect, but reverence that Christ wants, expects, and even demands from his wife. Ladies, I highly recommend in this regard, we're not going to go there, but 1 Peter chapter 3, verses 1 through 6, a part of which reads, "Even as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord." That's not merely respect. That's reverence. And that's what a man desires so much from his wife. Having said all of that, as it concerns our daughters, we also need to drill it and into and charge our sons that as young men, they need to be preparing themselves so as to merit such devotion from such a young lady. And don't overlook that many of the qualities that they will need to be such husbands and fathers are found in the leadership qualifications provided to us in 1 Timothy chapter 3 and Titus chapter 1 and certainly other places as well. Parents, in this regard, consider the problems that can be averted if our children's future, if in our children's future marriages, if in fact all of us who are still in that place with children of that age would only do this with our sons, with our daughters first and our sons as well. Teaching our daughters that don't even consider anyone whom you can't make such a commitment to, and teaching our sons to be such men that they would deserve such young ladies who would put such a devotion into them. We must get our own lives, of course, our own lives and homes in order first, and then both by example and by instruction pass on to our children these which are probably the most important lessons, instructions for their success as future husbands and wives, and which are, back to where we began, non-optional for biblical leadership in ours and their homes and beyond, if God so chooses that young man to be a leader of some type in the greater ecclesia. In the last message, I pointed out that the leadership qualification of having our homes in order does not mean that a man's children must be perfect. Or, as I mentioned, no one would ever qualify. So that's obviously not a part of the qualification. And that reflects more on the father than it does the children. Because I guarantee you, left to themselves, children are never going to accomplish what needs to be accomplished in this particular area. Consequently, a man qualified in this area is not someone who tries to cover up or makes excuses for his children's misdeeds, but who instead addresses their misbehavior, whether at home or in public, and this day and age to whatever degree that can be. And note I said addresses their misbehavior, which takes more than just a word. That is, until a word is all that's needed. You see, it's the training that gets them to that point. You know, Jared's somewhat of a good example in that. He was one smart little guy. I didn't have to discipline him a small percentage to what I had to do the others. He watched the others get it. He said, "Hey, I don't want any part of that." And he figured out early that, you know, I'm going to be a good boy. And not that my other children were generally good boys and good girls, but they took a little bit more training. Jared could see it firsthand watching it, and he said, "Hey, I'm going to do otherwise." And so For him, it didn't even, sometimes that's all it did take, was just a word. In fact, for Jared, sometimes it only took a look. Boy, he was hopping to whatever needed to be hopped to. But that is the exception. And I can say it for nearly all of us, not just my three older children, but it's the exception for all of us. And therefore, addressing their issues, addressing those problems, takes more than just a word, again, until it only takes just a word. And to do otherwise, fathers. To do otherwise, fathers, is to both you and your child a terrible disservice. Terrible disservice. And disqualifies you from ecclesiastical leadership. This qualification not only demands that one's children be in subjection to you, but that they are also in subjection to Yahweh. That is, that they are faithful unto the Lord to whatever degree possible at their given age. Titus chapter 1, verses 5 and 6, again, which we read last week, it says, "Ordain elders in every city as I had appointed thee, if any be blameless, the husband of one wife, having faithful children, not accused of riot or unruly." Young's literal translation has it, "having children steadfast." The Bible in Basic English has it, "whose children are of the faith." And the New American Standard has it, "having children who believe." This qualification is thus also somewhat of an age qualifier. That is, that the man must be old enough, must have been at this parenting thing long enough to have children. I don't think it necessarily requires all of them, but to have children, at least two, who have made some kind of confession to the Lord on their own accord. They have already, he's got children that are believing in the Lord, evidence of the fact that he's, in fact, not just ruling his household, but ruling his household well, particularly as it concerns the spiritual aspects and their relationship with Christ. And which only makes sense, being that such a man is to have had a family long enough to have proved, not his children, but to have proved himself faithful in ruling his own household well. And thus, you don't take a man that's just newly married and has little toddlers, but you wait until the man has proved himself with those little toddlers to where they have grown old enough to make at least some kind of confession to the Lord or of the Lord. Now, with that said, there's something else that needs to be understood about this requirement. Something, again, that this requirement is not. It's not a requirement that after one's children have reached adulthood, which is 20 years of age, and left home, that they must remain faithful in order for him to remain qualified. It only applies to the candidate's children while under the man's direct control and command. He is not responsible and should not be judged for what his grown children do after leaving home. The very fact that he's maintained order in his home for what otherwise would have been or turned out to be rebellious children is evidence not that he's unqualified, but that in fact he's qualified. You see that? A man who kept his house in order despite a child's rebellious tendencies that were manifest not while in his home so much as they were after leaving his covering is the very kind of man you want in that position. The very thing that some men would be disqualified by others is in fact evidence of their in fact being qualified. And so, it's not a qualification. You know, I know men who have ruled their household well in that regard, and who have lost some of their children in the process. But while in their home, they had control. and they discipline their children. And thus, they're not disqualified, again, by children who have left their covering. Now, more could be said regarding this particular qualification, but hopefully enough said at this point. So, let's move on to the next qualification. Back to 1 Timothy chapter 3. And verse 2 again. And it says, a bishop then must be blameless, the husband of one wife. I'm reading King James. The next qualification, according to the King James, is vigilant. Vigilant. Now, while I like the word vigilant, and while it is certainly true that leaders need to be vigilant, ever watchful for lions and wolves and serpents and other dangers, in 1611, when the King James was translated, this is not what the word meant. What we understand vigilant, in other words, today, to mean is not what it meant at that time. The New American Standard translates it as temperate. The English Standard Version as sober-minded, and the Bible in Basic English as self-controlled. Strong's defines the word as sober, and I'm going to add this part of it, not as not a drunkard, but sober-minded as in the English Standard Version. It translates it as sober and thus as circumspect. Webster's Collegiate Dictionary defines sober as, quote, marked by seriousness, solemnity, subdued in tone as color, not flashy or showy. See if you can think of some people that don't fit this quality. Again, marked by seriousness, solemnity, subdued in tone as color, not flashy or showy, free from excess, extravagance, or exaggeration, showing self-control, sane, or rational. End of quote. Now, I don't know about you, but that eliminates about every televangelist I've ever seen on TV. Pretty much. And circumspect, Webster's Dictionary defines circumspect as discreet, cautious, and prudent. Now, I think probably, at least for me, self-controlled probably depicts it best, along with one who takes serious, dead serious, his responsibility, his obligations as a leader. And in that regard, Ezra and Nehemiah, for example, came to mind for me. Ezra, who in Ezra 7:10 declared the following. It says, for Ezra had prepared his heart, he started with his own heart, to seek the law of Yahweh, and to do it, and to teach Israel his statutes and judgments. And then Nehemiah, who would not be diverted from his duties, and who responded, oh no, regarding being sidetracked with meeting his enemies in Ono. Men who were dead serious about their responsibilities. The Apostle Paul comes to mind, who traveled extensively in his missionary journeys, if you will, to expand the kingdom, and who prayed unceasingly for so many others. And if you want an example of a prayer warrior, the Apostle Paul was a prayer warrior. And sometimes I think that's overlooked in the Apostle. There's so many other qualities about the Apostle Paul that we appreciate. But you read the epistles, and he constantly was talking about how he was praying for these people, for so many things, and so many people, in so many different ways, and for so many different things. He took his work seriously. And who couldn't think of Moses, who led the cantankerous and often disobedient Israelites for 40 years in the wilderness? Even had the opportunity very soon on to start over with his own descendants. How much easier it would have been, but he took seriously his job and prayed to God, and he said, let it not be, God, lest your enemies ridicule you for having brought them out of Egypt and having lost them here. These were leaders who took very seriously their responsibilities. Now, having said that, let me tell you, such a leader loves to have a good laugh. In fact, they probably need it more than the average man. But, having said that, such a man is not a goof-off, with the exception of with his children. I got to throw that one in there because to save my own face. He's not prone to extremes or flights of fancy. I think all wrapped up in this word, vigilant, as we find it in the King James, or what were the other ones? What was the ones we just looked at? Circumspect and sober. I think all of this is wrapped up in that. He's not prone to extremes or flights of fancies, and while he may be and likely is a visionary, he doesn't live in a dream world, but is instead intently involved in the here and now for both his and future generations. These are things in which we also need to be training our sons in particular. You know, most young men today, at least from what I can see, live in a dream world, in very little reality whatsoever, with no concern of anything more important than oftentimes what's found on their computer screen in the world of the internet or in their video games. They live in a dream world, something which young men, to begin with, have more of a tendency, I think, toward than our young women do, and which is being facilitated and, you might even say, animated and exaggerated by much of what is found on the internet, with whom so many are spending volumes of their time on. Consequently, we need to be doing everything that we can to instill within our sons a vision, not just a dream, but a vision for the kingdom, so that regardless their life pursuit, they become possessed with seeking first Yahweh's kingdom and His righteousness. And if this is true, that in itself will go a long way toward them becoming the type of young men in whom a young lady can devote the remainder of her life following and help meeting, if it's not a word, and if you don't mind me coining that. That one thing alone will go a long way toward instilling in our young ladies the willingness to follow such a young man. The next qualification is somewhat similar. 1 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 2 again, going a little bit further. It says, a bishop then must be blameless, the husband of one wife, vigilant, and then the word sober. And we already know that the word, the Greek word translated vigilant here is by Strong's defined as part of the definition being sober. So we can see that there's some crossover here in these words and definitions. New American Standard has it prudent. The English Standard Version has it respectable, and Darby's has it as discreet. It's the same Greek word translated modest in the phrase that, quote, that women adorn themselves in modest apparel. Not so much, I think, although it would certainly include modesty as we think of it today, but modest in just the overall aspect of it, which would in fact always include modesty in a sexual sense as well. And which is, we find in 1 Timothy 2:9, and which is the only other time that this particular word is used, in fact. Now, when you think of someone who's prudent and or modest in the Bible, in the Bible, who comes to mind? Does anybody come to mind somebody who's prudent or somebody who is modest? Well, I'll tell you somebody who came to mind, and that's Saul, the first king of Israel. Although that wasn't what he later became. You know, if you think about him at first, he was modest. You know, he said, what are you talking about? You know, why are you, Samuel, choosing me of all people? I'm the least of my people in the tribe of my people, of the Benjamites. And then when they finally did throw lots, he was off there hiding in the luggage or the stuff, as it says in the King James, somewhere hiding so that he couldn't be found. He was so modest and didn't think that he deserved to be so. Regrettably, that changed, and men can change. But initially, he was a modest man whom God chose. So even King Saul, we don't normally remember him for that, but even in the beginning, he was a man whom would probably have fulfilled this particular qualification. John the Immerser. Who wouldn't think of John the Immerser in both his dress and particularly in his demeanor and conduct, who once said, he, speaking of Christ, he must increase, but I must decrease. And isn't that a non-optional leadership attribute that all of us should possess? The same as displayed by John the Immerser? In fact, it was the lack of this very attribute for which Yahweh chastened. Not much said about this man, but here is what we do have from Yahweh, as Yahweh chastened Jeremiah's companion Baruch. In Jeremiah 45:5, Yahweh speaking to Baruch, he says, And seekest great things for thyself? Boy, how many modern day Baruchs do we have today? Seekest thou great things for thyself? And then he simply said after that, seek them not. Seek them not. Very few men would be of such as John the Baptist. And if not great things for yourself, then for who or what? You know, because every man wants to pursue greatness, or at least there are very few men who don't. But it's inherent within us, as leadership is inherent within us to some degree, to seek greatness. And so if not for ourselves, then for who or what? Matthew 6:33. Seek first His kingdom and His righteousness and all of these things, including greatness. At least greatness in Yahweh's eyes, in many cases or many instances, will be added unto you. And even if it's not, the very seeking of Yahweh's kingdom and His righteousness is a pursuit of greatness in and of itself. One who leads on behalf of Yahweh does not promote himself, but instead he recognizes and promotes Yahweh's greatness, knowing that all things come from His hand. As in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, where it says, not many of you were wise, not many of you were mighty when you were called, but He chose the weak and the foolish to shame the wise. And then He ends the chapter by saying, so that Yahweh may be glorified. He chose the weak and the simple and the foolish, that He might be glorified, because in Him we are what we are, if there's any greatness whatsoever. It's the same thing Paul possessed in 1 Corinthians 3:7, where he wrote, quote, so then neither is he that planteth anything, neither is he that watereth, but God who giveth the increase. And it was for that reason, I believe, that he also wrote in 1 Corinthians chapter 2 and verse 2, that he wrote, for I am determined to know nothing among you except Jesus or Yeshua the Christ and Him crucified. I am determined to know nothing among you except Yeshua and Him crucified. Because he understood that in knowing Christ, in whom are hid all the treasures of wisdom and knowledge, Colossians 2:3. Ultimately, in knowing Him, Paul understood that ultimately that he would know everything there is to know about everything, ultimately. And that without knowing Christ, that he could never, never know anything as it's intended to be known. Thus, of course, the premier leadership quality, the prerequisite to everything else, is intimately knowing Christ and seeking first His kingdom. Which I at least believe is somewhat inherent in this one word, sober, as a qualification for leadership. And it is where everything for us begins, in Him. And thus, a good place to conclude this message as well. After all, He is the Alpha and the Omega, and the beginning and the end. Everything begins with Him, and everything ends with Him. And particularly, as it concerns non-optional leadership. Let's stand, we'll close in prayer. Heavenly Father, we come before You, Lord, as always, very humble, and yet You've provided that, Lord, even in that, we can be bold, not in ourselves, but in Christ. And we're so thankful, Lord, for Your willingness to hear us, to allow us into Your presence, and Father, to have reached down and touched us, Father, with the life, death, burial, and resurrection of Christ. And that in that, we have not only a hope of life here on earth that is much better than is offered in any other fashion, but also life beyond this life in the resurrection and in the change of those of us who will be changed into His likeness. But even while here, Lord, to be able to look, Father, for so much more that provides us the means to lead others, not for our own sake, but Father, for the sake of Christ and for Your sake, to Your praise and glory. Let it be so that we would pursue these things of excellence, Lord, that we might indeed be used to point others to You, to lead others to the cross and to the empty tomb. We ask these things and praise You, Father, for them in Yeshua the Christ. Amen.